sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Joshua Max Feldman, author of Start Without Me, the new Jewish Thanksgiving-based novel. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shin Shinim Chen Dinachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Official comic genius Larry David hosted Saturday Night Live last weekend, a signal honor for the creator of Seinfeld and the creator and star of Curb Your Enthusiasm, otherwise known as The Larry David Show.
I know I consistently strive to be a good Jewish representative. When people see me, I want them to say, oh, there goes a fine Jew for you. There's a fine Jew. Margaret, come here. Come here. I want you to meet this wonderful Jew. Nothing stereotypical about him. If not for the self-deprecation and the irritable bowel syndrome, you'd never know in a million years.
On Saturday Night Live, however, Larry David managed to be both not terribly funny, no great surprise on the wildly uneven iconic classic comedy show now in its 42nd year, but also offensive, also no great surprise on SNL. This time, however, it was a Holocaust joke about trying to make time with women while a prisoner in a concentration camp that struck a dismal chord and provoked controversy.
There are no good opening lines in a concentration camp. How's it going? They're treating you okay? You know, if we ever get out of here, I'd love to take you out for some latkes. You like latkes? What? What'd I say? Is it me or is it the whole thing? It's because I'm bald, isn't it?
Not actually funny. As we might remember, Jerry Seinfeld had a famous take on those who use comedy inappropriately from an episode about a dentist, played by Bryan Cranston, by the way, who converts to Judaism. In the scene, Jerry goes to tell a priest about the problem and has to meet him in the confessional.
Tell me your sins, my son.
I should mention that I'm Jewish.
Well, that's no sin.
Oh, good. Anyway, I wanted to talk to you about Dr. Whatley. I have a suspicion that he's converted to Judaism purely for the jokes.
And this offends you as a Jewish person?
No, it offends me as a comedian.
In any case, Larry David's problem on Saturday Night Live was not just that he told a Holocaust joke. Others have done so successfully without as much controversy, like, you know, Mel Brooks, but that it wasn't funny enough to make up for the offense it engendered. Not the last time that will happen, I'm afraid. That Larry David Holocaust joke incident does bring up Saturday Night Live, one of the most important comic institutions in American history. Saturday Night Live was, of course, created by a Jewish guy who still runs it over four decades after it began in 1975. Lorne Michaels' real name is Lorne David Lipowitz, a Jewish comedy writer and producer from Toronto, Canada, who was approached by NBC executives with a problem way back in 1974. That's the year I was bar mitzvahed. At 11:30 at night on Saturdays, they had been running The Best of Johnny Carson, the Tonight Show reruns. But Carson wanted to take more time off. Johnny wanted to save those great episodes to air in his regular time slot, rather than waste them in the middle of an unwatchable time like Saturday night at 11:30 p.m. And so NBC president Herb Schlosser, who was of course Jewish, approached his head of late night programming, Dick Ebersol, actually not Jewish, and asked him to come up with a show to cover that 11:30 p.m. time slot. Ebersol went to Lorne Michaels, and in 3 weeks they developed Michaels' idea for a variety show with sketches, political satire, and music to attract the then-young baby boom demographic that wasn't watching TV very much. Saturday Night Live first aired in 1975, and it was a hit, in spite of objections from NBC's executives and others who didn't approve of its sharper edge and looser standards. The talent Lorne Michaels assembled in that initial cast was stunning. Chevy Chase, John Belushi, Gilda Radner, Dan Aykroyd, Jane Curtin, Lorraine Newman, Garrett Morris, and in the second year, Bill Murray, and writers that included Al Franken, now the U.S. Senator from Minnesota. Lorne Michaels kept it rolling for 5 years, left for a creative break, then came back to save the show in 1985, and he has been there ever since. Saturday Night Live wasn't always very Jewish, but sketches like Samurai Moyle, Jacob the Bar Mitzvah Boy, Hanukkah Harry, and of course Adam Sandler's Hanukkah songs still resonate. And the show helped launch so many great comedy careers, plenty of them Jewish comedians. Adam Sandler, Billy Crystal, Tina Fey, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, John Lovitz, Andy Samberg, Sarah Silverman, Rob Schneider, Ben Stiller, and many more started or took off on SNL. And on the non-Jewish side, Eddie Murphy, Dana Carvey, Will Ferrell, Jimmy Fallon, Mike Myers, Dennis Miller, Chris Rock, Amy Poehler, Kristen Wiig, Martin Short, Norm MacDonald, Chris Farley, and many, many others got their starts on Saturday Night Live, all really courtesy of Lorne Michaels. You know, in fact, Lorne Michaels, something of a comedy tyrant by reputation, is actually pretty funny himself. As he said recently, "I don't tweet. I don't tweet for a very simple reason, which is that I drink." There are other people who could learn about that not tweeting. In many ways, Saturday Night Live is a kind of throwback to the early days of lives, comedy, sketch, television, and Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows was a likely model for Michaels, but updated, deliberately hip for each new generation, and willing to push the envelope. SNL is not always great, or even good, but when it's good, it really can be great. In any case, Larry David, your bad taste fail from your hosting appearance on SNL will not sink Lanceman Lorne Michaels' long-standing staple of late-night TV. Maybe you should apologize.
With all due respect, don't you think the sorry window is closed on that?
The sorry window? I didn't know there was a sorry window.
2 years? You're still getting sorries? I don't think so. That's a long time for sorries.
Or perhaps not. To play us in this morning on the theme of Jewish humor, here's a comedian who did not get his start on Saturday Night Live, but instead on SCTV. It's Rick Moranis, past guest of Too Jewish, and his very funny, very Jewish poo poo poo.
We ran into the Feldman's, man, did they look great. Mindy graduated with a 3.8. Milky says they're just about to renovate. And don't tell anybody, but Debbie is late. Poo, poo, poo. Poo, poo, poo. When it's too good to be true. Poo, poo, poo. Murray was indicted for insider trading. They moved the case to Delaware. They're sitting and waiting. Running up a legal tab, their hopes were fading. Then Murray and the judge's sister started dating. Poo, poo, poo. Just a logical position. I'm not claiming honest premonitions, just historically informed intuition. An evolutionary predisposition.
sell some blue, or so her sister told her. Herbal supplements and vitamins, the health food store sold her. Nothing worked till she stopped throwing salt over her shoulder. Poo, poo, poo.
That was Rick Moranis' splendid comic cut, Poo, Poo, Poo. Our guest this morning, also very Jewish, is Joshua Max Feldman, author of Start Without Me, a new Jewish Thanksgiving-based novel and a very entertaining one. Hear all about it when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish our guests this morning. Joshua Max Feldman has a new novel out about Thanksgiving, kind of. It's called Start Without Me. He is the author of the acclaimed first novel, The Book of Jonah, and we're glad to have him here. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so why did you decide to write a book about Thanksgiving?
I wrote a book about Thanksgiving because at some point I realized that my Thanksgivings have always been very dull, very predictable, very boring. Nobody ever fights at the table. There's never a disagreement about anything. And I wanted to explore Thanksgiving. That was totally different from that. I wanted to look at families and people where the Thanksgiving is just a real point of tension rather than comfort. I think that's a very common experience for a lot of people. And yeah, it was just a fun sandbox for me to want to play in.
I'm reminded just slightly of Avalon, the movie, which starts with a huge Thanksgiving dispute. But this is really not Avalon that you're writing about. A Jewish family, but complicated one, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I want it to be true to a sort of multicultural, unconventional, you know, by traditional terms, kind of Jewish family. I think that's a story that doesn't get told a lot. And for me, it was a lot of fun to look at those characters and explore a kind of Jewish family, a strongly Jewish family that you don't often see.
Well, you know, I wonder what kinds of Jewish families we see today. It's a different world. Millennial Jewish families aren't the same as baby boom Jewish families, and gosh knows what's coming next. Were you trying to capture some of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, actually, as I reflect on it. I think the idea of what is Jewish in the popular mind can often be different than the idea of what's Jewish within the Jewish community. I think it's easier for those inside the Jewish community to recognize the sort of tectonic shifts that are happening in this generation, in the more recent generations. And maybe it is only from a sort of like the broader 30,000 foot perspective that it can look more homogenous. I think it is, you know, you make a great point that like the American Jewish experience certainly is evolving very, very quickly. It continues to evolve and change very, very quickly. And as I reflect upon it, I think, you know, it's important for, you know, looking at myself as a Jewish artist, for me to sort of take those changes into account. And the idea of what we think of as a Jewish family means many different things to many different people, and means things now that it probably didn't, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
When we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish, we'll continue to talk with Joshua Max Feldman. His new book is called Start Without Me, a very entertaining novel, kind of based around Thanksgiving. We'll be back in just a moment on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we've been talking about the revival of Jewish life in Eastern Europe. It started with Chabad and then the Reform Movement and other institutions. Then last week we talked about the Lauder Foundation and its role in recreating or reestablishing Jewish institutions, schools, community centers, other old age homes. You know, one of the really crucial places for Jews from Eastern Europe that I just learned about last winter, and you've known it for a while, is the Jewish camp institutions, particularly Camp Sarvash in Hungary. Let's talk a little bit about how that has played such a key role in identity there.
Okay, I'm not sure what that camp is called. It's in Sarvash.
Oh, sorry, it's in Sarvash.
But I don't know that it's called Camp Sarvash.
No, I think you're probably right. It's called something else, but go ahead.
But, you know, you bring up a good point more generically, also for American Jewry, the role of summer camping in creating Jewish identity. Like, there are young people in Eastern Europe whose cities no longer have functioning synagogues or temples at all. There may not even be a minyan in somebody's house. But these young people have a strong Jewish identity thanks to going to summer camp with other young people from all over, mostly Southeastern Europe, I would say, in Sarvash, where they learn songs, they learn Hebrew, they learn to observe Shabbat to some extent. I mean, this is not probably orthopraxy. It's very inclusive. There are very few Jews, for example, in the former Yugoslavia who have two Jewish parents. But, you know, a practical decision was made to be welcoming and inclusive of anybody who wanted to attend. So there's people from probably a dozen countries who go to Sarvash thanks to the Soros Foundation. And, you know, I think it's something that adults, particularly if they don't have young kids, they overlook the role of Jewish summer camps in the creation of Jewish identity. We think in terms of schools, Hebrew schools, Sunday schools, whatever, synagogues, temples.
GCC.
Yeah, we tend to underestimate. And, you know, I'm a product of the Camp Ramah movement, which was probably one of the oldest intentional Jewish educational summer camps in the U.S. Officially, it was Hebrew speaking back in the 1950s. De facto, it was. It became a little less so. But still, there's a Camp Ramah Hebrew and a Camp Ramah identity. And all kinds of surveys have been done showing that a positive summer camp experience for a teenage Jew can create a lifelong affinity for Jewish community, Jewish institution. It often turns people into community leaders, so-called lay leaders, or it encourages them to become Jewish professionals, teachers, rabbis, cantors, whatever. And I wouldn't say that Ramah is necessarily the best at this, but it's certainly one of the oldest, one of the most well-known. And at one point, and I don't know if this is still the case, but they had branches in Sweden, in Argentina, in Israel, and all over Canada and the U.S.
So I want to add one element about talking about the Eastern European camp. I met with a Neolog rabbi and his wife who both had gone through the camp at Sarvash, and that really set them on the course for their future. Neolog is sort of somewhere between conservative and orthodox in right. Hungary. It's kind of its unique movement. And that was a common story for people who came from atheist communist homes who had one Jewish parent. They went to the Jewish camp. They got involved. They started to become active. And the same thing, of course, is still true for so many Jewish kids, not only around the world, but in America as well, as you say. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Tamir Shakuri and Chen Denachi, representing the Israel Center, the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So Israel's a small country, and, you know, for Americans, it's tiny. It's the smaller than Arizona. So when we look at it, we can't imagine that there's all of these incredible regional differences all over, but there are.
Yeah, so it's kind of weird because Israel is such a small country, but there's so many different kind of living in Israel. Like in the north, you could probably find like bigger houses and like a different vibe. Everyone's more calmed down.
A little more laid back.
People taking it slow, probably work with like animals or agriculture. And I mean, I know it's like that in a lot of places. It's just that for us, it's like a half an hour drive from Tel Aviv, which is like the most hectic, hurry up, New York of Israel kind of city.
Right. Lots of high tech and everybody's rushing from one job to the next and
can't drive,
traffic.
Yep. Yeah, and so that's really cool.
But in New York, you know, you have to drive more than 20 minutes to get to an agricultural quiet area. Well, until you have 20 minutes, may not actually move your car at all with the traffic. But there's also a distinction that people make between the Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Haifa, big city axis, and the coastal strip, and what's called the periphery. You know more about this maybe because you grew up in the periphery, right, Tamir?
Yep. So growing up in a periphery is kind of different. Well, I feel like I didn't get to experience how it's like to live in a big city just because I feel like I have everything I need in my small area, because we have like a small shopping center next to where I live, and all of my friends are like kind of in my same area, and my school is 5 minutes away from me by drive. So I feel like it's a very different experience, because you live your life when you're more about, I feel like I was more at home and more in my moshav than people in the city are like a lot at home. They feel like they have more to do, so they go out. You go out to the street and they find somewhere to go. But for me, before I had a car, it was only like, okay, I'll just go outside and play with my friends on the sidewalk. Like, it's because you can, because no one drives down the street. So it's very different. But there are peripheries that are weak in the social economical way. And that's very different. And that's because they are not in the center of Israel. And I feel like I was blessed to be in the more, the better part of the periphery. Like, I feel like I grew up in the periphery in its best way.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, obviously there's more jobs in Tel Aviv. And one thing that both of you guys agreed on is that people from Jerusalem are somehow different, the Yerushalmim.
Yeah, Yerushalmim. They kind of have different terms for things. Like, a piggyback ride in the rest of Israel would be Sakemach, in Jerusalem it would be Abu Yoyo.
Which is an Arabic term, maybe? I don't know.
No,
they made it up somehow.
They just made it up. And, you know, that's not an uncommon thing where Jerusalem just have a different terminology for everything.
You know, we have that same feeling about New York and the rest of America, where you guys are going to be soon. Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you. See you next week.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie goes to see the rabbi and complains about her bad headaches. She whines, she cries, she talks about her poor life, her awful family for hours and hours. All of a sudden, Sadie shouts overjoyed, "Rabbi, your holy presence has cured me. My headache is gone." And the rabbi replies, "No, Sadie, it's not gone. I have it now." That was the old Jewish joke, the week's special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Actually, I think I like the punchline, "No, Sadie, it's not gone. You gave it to me," even better. And now a word of Torah. This week's Torah portion of Toldot includes the treachery of Jacob and the foolishness of Esau, a famous story of brotherly rivalry that sets in motion this central tale in Genesis. It's a story of fraternal twins who are anything but fraternal in their interactions. Jacob is a lover of tents, a homebody, whose mother adores him. Esau is a hunter, an outdoorsman, a man active in the extreme and more or less devoid of forethought. In our weekly portion, Jacob fools his family twice. First, he cons the hungry Esau into selling his birthright, his inheritance, for a bowl of porridge. Then, at the instigation of his mother Rebekah, Jacob fools his father Isaac into giving him the principal blessing, the spiritual heritage, the leadership of the people who will someday be known as Israel. Why is it that Jacob is the one who will become the true father of our people? He is clever and verbal, cerebral, but he lacks basic moral qualities that we should find critical. Esau, too, is no bargain, however. Athletic and strong, he is all physical exertion and emotional outburst, instinctive but unreflective. Id to Jacob's superego. Neither brother is such a bargain. Neither is a complete good human being. One, Jacob, demonstrates the excesses of intellectual egotism and manipulation and narcissism. The other, Esau, shows the danger of acting purely from instinct and emotion. In fact, it is through both of them that the great story of God's oneness will be carried forward. The message is complicated but useful. The truth is that we are all, both Jacob and Esau, partly thoughtful, partly instinctive. We, each of us, are also twins in this sense. We can act with deliberation and care, or forcefully and without judgment. And we all have the capacity to be either good or bad. In that dichotomy lies our innate humanity. And in the persons of Esau and Jacob, we can see ourselves, the balance we need to seek between these halves. Through the life stories of these twins, we learn that it is only by finding a middle ground in our own conduct, and by God's favor, that we can truly find wholeness and perhaps our own promised land. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, author Joshua Max Feldman, will explain why his new novel, Start Without Me, revolves around Thanksgiving, and whether it's really a Jewish novel or not. Find out when we come back in a moment, right here on To Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Natalie Portman, a celebrated actress, director, and social activist, was named the winner of the 2018 Genesis Prize, the so-called Jewish Nobel, last week.
I definitely grew up being like, got to get good grades, I've got to get a good job, I've got to, you know, get married at a certain point. I know if I'm not given like sort of obstacles, I get kind of lazy. Like, I don't need to base my sense of self on what strangers' opinions of me are like.
Once your technique gets to a certain level, the only thing that separates you from others is your quirks or even flaws.
I think it's a really good tool, too, just to learn something from everyone you work with.
Natalie Portman joins artist Anish Kapoor, violinist Yitzhak Perlman, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and actor-director Michael Douglas as winners of the Million Dollar Prize, which honors individuals who serve as an inspiration to the next generation of Jews through their outstanding professional achievement, along with their commitment to Jewish values and the Jewish people. Portman's prize money will go to programs that focus on advancing women's equality. The funds will be used for grants to organizations involved in promoting women's educational opportunities, economic advancement, health and safety, and full participation in policy formulation and political activity. A significant portion of the Genesis Prize funds will go to programs advancing women's equality in Israel, the foundation said. Portman was born in Israel, and after moving to the U.S., she was actually born in Jerusalem, after moving to the U.S. as a three-year-old, she has retained a close connection to her Jewish and Israeli roots. Natalie Portman is a noted social activist in gender equality and combating poverty, microfinance, and animal rights as well. Portman began her acting career at the age of 12. 12 and began directing in recent years. She has won an Oscar, 2 Golden Globes, the British Academy of Film and Television Award, and other industry honors. In 2015, she directed A Tale of Love and Darkness, a Hebrew language film made in Israel based on the novel by Israeli author Amos Oz, in which she also played the starring role. Natalie's charismatic on-screen presence has touched the hearts of millions, said Stan Polovitz, co-founder and chairman of the Genesis Prize Foundation. Her talent, commitment to social causes, and deep connection to her Jewish and Israeli roots are greatly admired. She exemplifies the core traits of the Jewish character and values of the Jewish people. Persistence and hard work, pursuit of excellence, intellectual curiosity, and a heartfelt desire to contribute to making the world a better place. Without a doubt, she is a role model for millions of young Jews around the world. Portman, who in the statement said she is proud of my Israeli roots and Jewish heritage, will be honored at a ceremony in Jerusalem in June. The Genesis Foundation was endowed by the Genesis Philanthropy Group, a consortium of wealthy philanthropists and businessmen from the former Soviet Union. You know, while this award is prestigious, I am not sure that an award won by Michael Douglas, Natalie Portman, Michael Bloomberg, and Yitzhak Perlman is exactly a Jewish Nobel Prize. I mean, it's nice that a Star Wars star got it, but, well, on the other hand, Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature last year. So, maybe the Genesis Prize has similar standards. Last week, it was announced that the Günzburg Collection, one of the most important collections of Jewish books and manuscripts in the world, which is kept in the Russian State Library in Moscow, will now be digitized and made accessible to the general public by the National Library of Israel in Jerusalem. A historic agreement was signed between the Israeli National Library and its counterpart in Moscow. That is a milestone in the contacts between these two institutions. Those contacts began exactly 100 years ago, a century, when the National Library was still called the Beit HaSfarim HaLumi. The signing ceremony was attended by dignitaries from both sides, but the significant achievement conceals an Israeli defeat, at least temporarily, the failure to actually gain possession of this collection. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu recently admitted that fact indirectly when he said, "Without detracting from the demand to regain possession of the collection, we asked in the first stage to cooperate on the digitization of the collection in order to afford scholars high-quality access to these important materials." The director of the Russian State Library, Vladimir Gnezdilov, said, "Modern information technology has opened new and unlimited possibilities for accessing the cultural values of countries and their peoples." True enough. The Günzburg Collection is a rich and unique group of books and manuscripts containing over 14,000 items, including thousands of rare Hebrew books, manuscripts in Hebrew, and many other languages. It includes medieval works in science, philosophy, Jewish studies, Midrashim, copies of writings of Maimonides and the Rashba, biblical commentaries, books of Hebrew grammar and halacha, medieval poetry, Kabbalistic and medical texts, and much more. This collection was put together by 3 generations of an aristocratic Russian Jewish family beginning in the middle of the 19th century. In the early 20th century, it was considered one of the most important Judaica collections in the world, and it probably still is. There is no question that even today the collection is a national cultural treasure for the Jewish people, said Dr. Aviad Stolman of the National Library. In 1917, circle that date, a contract was signed for the purchase of the collection between Beit HaSfarim HaLumi and the Russian authorities of the time. 500,000 gold rubles were transferred to the Russians, about $15 million today, through donations by Russian Zionists. The books had already been placed in cartons, ready to be dispatched to Palestine, but delivery was delayed because of World War I. Then, with the outbreak of the Bolshevik Revolution, the books were seized, nationalized, and transferred to the Lenin State Library in Moscow. Albert Einstein, Chaim Weizmann, and later Bibi Netanyahu tried in vain to persuade the Russians to return this collection. In recent years, Israel broached the subject during official meetings with senior officials in Russia, with the involvement of the Israeli Foreign Ministry, with Netanyahu, and then Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. Israel sent Russia documents showing proof of ownership in the hope that the warming of relations between Russia and Israel would bring an end to this affair. Netanyahu even spoke about it several times with Russian President Vladimir Putin. But a few years ago, he realized that for now, there's no chance of Israel getting the collection, and therefore he advised the National Library to advance a digitization project without deciding at this point on ownership of the collection, which paved the way to the agreement this week. The digitization project was funded by the Perry Foundation, headed by Ziauddin Magomedov, a Russian Muslim billionaire businessman from Dagestan who is active in cultural preservation. Kind of neat. The Günzburg collection will now be accessible on the website Kativ, on which the National Library has posted tens of thousands of rare manuscripts. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Joshua Max Feldman is the author of The Book of Jonah and The New Start Without Me, a novel, kind of a Thanksgiving novel, but, well, it's kind of a lot more than that. You've lived a variety of places, according to your bio, England, Russia, Switzerland, and now that strange, bizarre country, Brooklyn. tell us, a, definitely, and maybe the most diverse. Tell us a little bit about how that life experience influences your writing. Are you one of those people that's always looking for grist for the mill?
That's a great question. I sort of joked when we were talking earlier about my Thanksgiving being sort of boring and predictable, and I mean that in a good way, I should clarify. But I think for a writer, you have to seek out new experiences, and you have to seek out things that push you out of your daily life and what you're expected. Like, I'm a creature of habit very much. I think habit is something that really helps an artist, having a predictable workflow, knowing where you're going to be every day. That really helps you as you sit down and do the work. But the other thing that informs the work is imagination. And that is fueled by putting yourself in situations that are completely different from your own. One thing that I really enjoyed in writing my most recent book, Start Without Me, is, you know, the main character, the protagonist, is a musician, which I'm not, and he also struggles with alcohol and is now sober, but that's not something I personally have dealt with, although people in my life have. But one thing that was enjoyable and very creatively satisfying about Start Without Me was seeking out people who've been in those situations, sitting down across from them, talking to them, hearing about their lives and their choices and their gifts and their challenges. And that's, you know, one of the best parts of writing fiction is inhabiting different worlds and different people's lives. And that was a real pleasure of this book.
You know, I think about the commonly understood truth that more people try to commit suicide around the holidays. and that, although for those of us who've had, you know, primarily really nice holidays, we don't kind of relate to that, but we know it's true if you've ever counseled or met with people. This book sort of teeters on the edge of catastrophe kind of throughout.
Well put. It does.
Was that a deliberate choice?
To your point about the holidays, I do think it is a time where you go in with an expectation that you're going to have a sort of warm, comforting domestic experience. And if you're not lucky enough to have that, or if you just don't have that, I think the loneliness meter just goes off the charts, because you feel like every doorway you pass, every window right behind it is this happy family where everyone's loved and supported. It's easy to think that from the outside looking in, but that's really not reality. And that is something I wanted to show in the book. It's that it's hard to feel like we're getting the holidays right. And that's certainly true of holidays like Thanksgiving. And I think it can be even more so true with some of the Jewish holidays, where there's all these ideas of like what we should be doing and what counts as authentic.
The characters, Adam and Marissa, who are the protagonists, you know, they meet in an interesting way. They have a complicated relationship. Was it based on anything in your own life?
The Adam and Marissa relationship?
Yes.
I would say it wasn't so much based on any particular relationship that I've had. It was more based around something I've observed with other people. I think that we can sometimes gravitate towards strangers when we find that our own intimate relationships can get very challenging. You know, Adam and Marissa are both characters who, you know, they're part of families. Marissa's married, but is the people who are filled with sort of conventional roles that they have the most trouble with. And I think in those situations, I think it's a pretty common situation, we can often find ourselves gravitating to strangers, because there's something about them that's a clean slate, and it's sort of like this, you know, untrammeled field that we can put whatever we want in it and be whoever we want to be.
Who influenced you the most in becoming a writer? What authors do you like the most?
That's a great question. I tend to gravitate towards Russian writers, I really like the sort of classic, huge Russian novel. Dostoevsky is a novelist that I love a lot. And I want to be clear that I don't put myself on that level. Like, that's not an author that I think is, like, a peer in any way. He's an inspiration for me because he is a brilliant psychological writer and paid a ton of attention to how people think. And that's something that I try to do in my own writing. I try to be really true to the way my characters think, the way they see the world, the way they see themselves, the things about themselves they don't understand. That probably comes from my upbringing, too, because I should confess that both my parents are psychologists. My sister is a psychologist, so psychological thinking is pretty deeply ingrained in me. But Dostoevsky and other Russian writers are authors who created characters that I find very psychologically compelling. And I think, authors who really pay attention to the life of the mind and the workings of the mind and how it gets us into all these trip problems.
When do you know that something's right in a book?
Wow, what a great question. Well, sooner or later, they take it away from you. At some point, your editor says, that's it. We got deadlines. You got to get it into production. So if it's right, if it's wrong, you don't want
it's going to get printed. It's how it is.
I tell people that, writing is, like 90% craft and 10% just inspiration. So a lot of it is sitting down, doing the work, applying like skills and tricks and things you've taught yourself, mistakes you've made in the past. But there is that part of it that's just those rare days when you really feel inspired. And rather than you leading the writing, you're just racing to catch up with the writing. And that's really the best feeling. And those are the moments when you just know deep down in your guts that for once you've gotten it right. And what you have on the page is something that's really good and really true to your thoughts and the story you're trying to tell.
I think it was Red Smith, a sports writer, who said, writing is easy. You just sit down at a typewriter until blood comes out of your forehead. Feels like that's
dramatic. Wow. Yeah. No, it does feel that way. I mean, and it's funny as you sort of think about as an author, it is the second novel that I've written. Right. You do sort of have a recovery period. You sort of feel like you've poured out a lot of yourself in writing these books, and it does take. There's sort of like an almost physical toll that you feel that it takes.
Is this a Jewish book?
Start Without Me, a Jewish book. That is a really great question. It certainly has major Jewish characters in it. And I think my approach to fiction is one that's really been informed by my understanding and my upbringing in Judaism. And I can talk a little bit about more what that means. But
yeah, can you clarify that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the synagogue that I was raised in, I want to speak very specifically about, my own Jewish experience. I'm not trying to make generalizations for everybody else.
Sure.
But for me personally, there's a lot of attention in the Judaism that I was raised in and the Judaism that I practice now that I want to bring my daughter up in. There's a lot of regard for the world we live in here and how we're treating other people and what we're doing for this world. Jewish spiritual practice and customs is a lot about emphasizing what's holy among people and what's holy in the world. And I think in that approach, which is also somewhat the approach that I take to fiction, I try to look at primarily the relationships between people. And in a book like Start Without Me, two strangers meeting who really end up helping each other in these profound ways. I think there is a lot of overlap between that kind of thinking and the sort of religious approach that I take in my own life and in my own practice of Judaism. But it's hard,
By the way, you're allowed to talk about which synagogue it was, if you want.
Jewish Community of Amherst, Massachusetts.
There you go.
Rabbi Sheila Weinberg. Yeah, no, it was great. It was fantastic. I was blessed with really an awesome community that I grew up in. In terms of like whether the book is Jewish or not, I mean, I guess on the one hand, I would say I don't know, but I think the more honest question is I hope so. I hope Jewish readers look at the book and see something that aligns with some of what they've learned and what they feel about being Jewish.
Do you feel like it's a kind of a redemption story?
That is a great question. I don't know. I didn't want to have a pat happy ending. I don't want to give away too much about the novel.
No, right. No spoiler alerts here.
We don't get any spoilers here. I guess what I'd say is that to the extent that at the beginning of this Thanksgiving, Adam and Marissa, the two protagonists, are people who have real needs, and they meet another person in each other. They find each other. They form this, I guess, what you call a friendship. And that friendship doesn't solve all their problems. In some cases, it creates some problems, but it helps them, for both of them, they get through a difficult day. And I think they're a little closer to where they want to be at the end of the day than the beginning. So I don't know if that counts as redemption. That's kind of a sort of prosaic small redemption. But, those are the kind of stories that interest me. I like the idea of how we help each other and how human beings find each other, help each other, and you fill in some of the blanks that we all have.
What do you hope for this Thanksgiving for yourself and for your book?
Well, for myself, I hope stuffing, some quality stuffing.
Lots of stuffing.
My way.
Yep.
Stuffing's my thing.
Absolutely.
I hope that, my Thanksgivings have always been at my parents' house, where I'm from, where my synagogue is in Amherst, Massachusetts. If I'm lucky, God willing, I'll be back around that table again this year. That consistency and predictability is really, really wonderful. And in terms of the book, look, you put these things out into the world, and it's a big mystery how people are going to react. You never know what people are going to make of your characters or your story. My hope with every person who picks up the book is that I hope they find something honest between the covers, because that I feel is my primary duty as a writer, is just go out there and tell the truth. There's so many situations, people, forms of media in public life that don't tell the truth, that don't try to tell the truth. I do my best as a novelist to tell the truth, as much truth as I can put in my fiction. And yeah, that's what I hope any Thanksgiving reader or otherwise finds when they pick up Start Without Me.
I have to say, not only is there truth, but these are very entertaining characters. Not always likable, but sometimes.
As with most people, nobody's likable all the time.
Boy, is that ever true. The book is called Start Without Me. It's by Joshua Max Feldman. It's a delightful second novel. What's your next book going to be about? Do you know?
Well, that's the million-dollar question.
Well, I hope the advance is that large, although I know
it's
that's not customary.
It's literally $1 million question. I'm literally going to have $1 million for it. No, I don't know. When I finished the Book of Jonah, my first novel, having finished Star Without Me, I just tried to reset and take in as much art, culture, reading, television, whatever I can to sort of refill the batteries. And yeah, eventually I'll sit down with a story and I'll probably tell myself, oh, this is going to be a short story. I'll write it quickly, no problem. And then, 3 or 4 years later, I'll look up and realize that, I've managed to make my way through another novel. These things always take on a life of their own, and then it's Frankenstein, and you're just trying to keep up with what the thing itself is doing.
Funny how these things create themselves after you put all that effort in. Again, the book is Start Without Me by Joshua Max Feldman. Where can people go to find out more about you?
You can check out my website, joshuamaxfeldman.com. All the information about me and the book is there. I'm also very active on Twitter at @jmaxfeldman and on Facebook as well, facebook.com/Joshua Max Feldman.
Thanks so much. And very importantly, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and all your listeners. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Eshkol Nevo, best-selling Israeli novelist, author of the outstanding new book, Three Floors Up. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website, top 10 Jewish podcasts in America. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from the Sephardic singer Amina Alaoui, her version of a classic song, Eli Hamia. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
salvar del amor. Tiene mi luta pece preto para salvar del amor.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.